There. So, greetings from the wet and soggy and damp West Coast. But the cherry trees, the cherry blossoms are in full bloom, and they're really gorgeous. So, spring is pretty well here. We just can't get into the garden because it's too wet. It's really nice to see you all again. If you missed the first one of these, it is posted on the Mountain Rain website under teachings. You can find it. But I'm not going to review too much. And I hope you have a copy that you can look on with as we go through this somewhat difficult text. You know, it's not, I mean, all the Zen texts are not easy. I don't know what I would call the easiest, but this is not, definitely not a contender for the easiest. And yet it has its own riches and surprises to be discovered with a little digging, decoding of some of the difficult parts. So, for anybody who missed the first time, it is a poem called Song of Jewel Mirror Samadhi, Hokyo Zanmai in Japanese, by Dongshan Liangjie, who in the 9th century founded the Caodong school of Chan, which is the Soto school of Zen. So it's he is our ancestor, our Zen ancestor. And just to review a bit, that very first line in the poem tells us that we are receiving the teaching of thusness, passed down from our Buddhist and Zen ancestors. And then the whole poem goes on to describe the indescribable Dharma of thusness, using as its primary metaphor this image of the jewel mirror. The jewel mirror as clear, unobstructed awareness, beholding the world of form, and yet not separate from form. In ancient China and Japan, mirrors were often made of bronze rather than silvered glass as they are today. And so they needed frequent polishing or they'd get discolored. So you can see how this image of the mirror appealed as a metaphor for the mind that we polish clean in our Zazen practice. And you can also see the source of the legendary poetry contest by which the 6th Zen ancestor, Huineng, was given Dharma succession. I suspect many of you know this story. And a very short version goes like this. The abbot, Hongren, asked his students to demonstrate their understanding by writing a verse. So the head monk, Shunshu, was quite confident that he would win and calligraphed his verse on the wall. And his verse was, "The body is the Bodhi tree, the mind is like a bright mirror's stand. At all times we must strive to polish it and must not let dust collect." So Huineng was an illiterate woodcutter who had come to work at the monastery. There's a backstory, but I won't go into that now. And he heard a young monk chanting Shunshu's poem. So he asked someone to write down his own poem on the wall. And there were two versions of his in the Platform Sutra, which is about and by and about Huineng. So Weinong's version was, Bodhi originally has no tree. The mirror has no stand. The Buddha nature is always clear and pure. What is there room? Where is there room for dust? And then the second version, the mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the bright mirror stand. The bright mirror is originally clear and pure. Where could there be any dust? So the second two lines were pretty similar. So here's that paradox that became Dogen's lifelong koan. If we are inherently of Buddha nature, why do we have to practice so hard to attain Buddhahood? Right? That's what Dogen started to ask when he was still a very young man. And you could say Dogen's life work was his teaching in Shobo Genzo was in investigating deeply. Those are his words. He says, investigate this deeply, investigate this thoroughly, investigate this thoroughly, was his thorough investigation of this paradox. And one place that he does that is in a fascicle of the Shobo Genzo called Old Mirror. And I was looking at it, I was thinking, oh, we'll have to take this one up for our yearly Dogen study retreat one of these days. Because the fascicle Old Mirror is just full of all of these stories about mirrors. One after the other, Dogen just collected all these old stories about mirrors. The opening lines of this fascicle are, what all Buddhas and ancestors have maintained and transmitted person to person is an old mirror. This is one seeing, one face, one image, one casting, meaning of a bronze mirror, one casting, one practice, and one realization. This old mirror, I'm going to read that again because I like it. This is one seeing, one face, one image, one casting, one practice, and one realization. So Dogen tells all these stories about mirrors, including the one I just told you about, Huineng, and another one, perhaps the most famous, an encounter between Nanyue, who was said to be Huineng's student, and his student, Mazu. And I'm sure some of you, if not all, have heard this one too. It goes, when Nanyue was visiting his hut, Mazu stood up. Nanyue said, what have you been doing these days? Mazu said, I've just been sitting. Nanyue said, what is your intention in just sitting? Mazu, I intend to become a Buddha. So Nanyue picked up a tile, like a roof tile that had fallen off a roof, say, and he started polishing it on a stone, or with a stone, maybe, I'm thinking. And Mazu said, Master, what are you doing? Polishing a tile. Why are you polishing the tile? I'm trying to make a mirror. How can you polish a tile and make a mirror? How can you do zazen and become a Buddha? Great story. So Dogen gives a lot of commentary on this story in his usual way. He takes the conventional understanding of the story and he turns it this way and that to nudge us free of any sort of preconceived conclusions. For example, this is one thing he says. Without polishing a tile, how can a great sage have the skillful means to make a true person? The capacity of making a true person is the bones and marrow of Buddha ancestors. Although it is fabricated, it is a furnishing of the house. So he helps us see this image of Nanyue picking up the tile and polishing it as a skillful means in teaching his student, helping his student to become a true person. And yes, at the same time that it's fabricated, you know, it's a device. It's insubstantial. It serves a purpose, like the furnishings in the house, he says. And in closing, I'm not going to give you all of this. This is just to give you a little taste of how Dogen does this. In closing, Dogen says, if a tile does not become a mirror, a human being does not become a Buddha. If you look down at a tile as a lump of mud, you look down at a human being as a lump of mud. If a human has a mind, a tile should have a mind. Who knows that there is a mirror that is brought forth as a tile and actualized as a tile? Who knows that there is a mirror that is brought forth as a mirror and actualized as a mirror? So he's just reminding us that the tile, the mirror, the human being sitting in Zazen are all manifesting Buddha nature just as they are. And to warn us against setting up a kind of division or hierarchy there. So that's just a little preamble. Let's get back to the song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi and pick up where we left off. And maybe we'll see some ways that this kind of relates to these old mirror stories. So I'm going to start, if you have the same copy that I sent out, it's number six. And it goes, although it is not fabricated, it is not without speech. So there's that word fabricated again. And it, we're going to see it a lot of times in this text, right? And it is referring back to the very first sentence, the Dharma of thusness, we could call it. Thusness. Existence. How could thusness? This whole poem is about the indescribability of thusness. But we could say thusness is existence manifesting in a space-time moment. You know, just this. It's kind of a holographic image. That moment, that manifestation moment, Dogen calls a Dharma position. And if anybody remembers Dogen's fascicle Being Time, he calls this manifesting moment a Dharma position, which contains all space and time in that moment of manifesting. So it, thusness, is not fabricated, is one way of translating that line. The Chinese Chan master, who's one of the few commentaries that I could find on this poem, he says, though this is not a way of action, the character, I've been looking at the this has been fun for me because I hadn't done this before. I had been looking at the Japanese. Here it is. See, that's what it looks like. This is the Soto Zen chant book that they use in Japan. And the character for fabricated here, translated as fabricated, or as Shunyan says, not a way of action, can be translated also as to be of use or benefit. So, thusness is not fabricated, not of use, and yet not without words. Or we could say not without expression. Right? Dogen likes to use the word, you talk about expression. So here we have another paradox, right? It's not a way of action, it's not fabricated, and yet it's not without expression. So that verse goes on, it is like facing a jewel mirror, form and image behold each other. So the perceiver and the perceived co-arise in the moment of perceiving. And then in the very next moment, there's change. But these moments of manifesting, these Dharma positions I mentioned, that Dogen calls them, they're not chopped up distinct entities. They are only a continuous flow. Like the stream Dongshan crossed after leaving his teacher. Remember I told you that story last time. Dongshan crossing the stream and looking down at his reflection and then writing the verse. Just don't seek from others or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone. Everywhere I meet it. It now is me. I now am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with suchness. So here's that line, looking at verse 7, you are not it, in truth it is you. Same lines as appeared in Dongchan's poem, that's kind of considered his enlightenment poem. Now, in all these previous lines that we've been reading, whenever in English it says it, there's actually no subject in the Chinese or Japanese. It's understood to be thusness, but we're not seeing it, or thusness. Thusness only appears in the very first line of the whole thing. So it's understood. Presents a bit of a challenge for the translator, to be sure. But in this case, in this line, you are not it, in truth it is you, that's the only place where the it is actually a character that can also mean he. And that's because it's referencing back to that poem that Dongshan read, which has the double meaning of his teacher, because he had departed from his teacher. So the you are not it, in truth it is you. You are not him, in truth he is you. It has that double meaning, which is really quite poignant, I think. That the it can be both thusness and Dongshan's teacher, Yunyan. And maybe that's what it's like as we go through the world. Whoever we meet, whatever we meet, it is us and we are not it, right? So continuing in that verse 7, like a babe in the world in five aspects complete, it does not go or come, nor rise nor stand. So five aspects here refers basically to the five senses that we are born with as infants. So we have those capacities, unless we are impaired in some way, we have those capacities from birth. Now, according to Shang Yan's commentary, he says it can also refer to the five merits of the Buddha, which are precepts, samadhi, wisdom, liberation, and wisdom derived from liberation. And he gives an explanation of that. I hadn't heard of those particular set of five before. I'm more familiar with the five paramitas, and I think you probably are as well. The paramitas, generosity, morality, patience, energy, concentration, and wisdom. So I think you could say the same thing with these five aspects, that we have these capacities complete inherently within us to be activated in our lives of practice. So it, the Dharma of thusness, does not go or come, nor rise nor stand. It is what it is. To use that, what has become kind of a cultural meme. Do you hear people saying it is what it is all the time? I thought, I've been hearing that, and it sounds kind of Zen-y, and I think they don't know anything about Zen. Why are they saying it is what it is? And so I'm hearing it all over. And so So I Googled it. I wondered, you know, how this came to be. And my internet research has revealed that one possible derivation of this saying is a short little video clip of unknown origin of five black teenage boys, probably somewhere, I'm thinking, in Africa. And one of them says, "It is what it is." And then the others start giggling and dancing and saying, "It is what it is. It is what it is," together. And apparently this short little video clip went viral, and then all other people started making little video clips going of, "It is what it is." And I don't know if that's true, the derivation of this cultural meme, but it certainly has caught on and people are saying it all the time. But the way they seem to most typically be using it is with the implication of, oh well, nothing we can do about it. You know, c'est la vie. Or in Japanese, shikata ganai, which means nothing can be done about it. And that's not really what thusness is. Thusness is about, it's not about passivity, it's about co-arising. Co-arising, co-manifestation. And that's not easy to describe or explain. So, verse 8, Baba Wawa, is there anything said or not? Great line. In Japanese, it's Baba Wawa Ukumuku. So Baba Wawa is indeed nonsense. But Ukumuku isn't. Ku is like a phrase, you know, a piece of language. So Uku means is language, is a phrase, and muku means not. You know, mu is negation, not in Zen. So uku is a phrase, muku not a phrase. But ukumuku, baba wawa ukumuku, cleverly reinforces that sense of meaningless babble, doesn't it? So if you were chanting this in Japanese, you would kind of... have that extra added feeling of just, this is really hard to talk about, right? So in verse number 9, ultimately, it does not apprehend anything because its speech is not yet correct. In these lines, I think the use of it is confusing because up to now, it has been referring to thusness. But here the subject is not stated, and I really think that it makes more sense for it here to be referring to you or we, more generously, we. So if we read it, ultimately, we do not apprehend anything because our speech is not yet correct. Right? So baba wawa ukumuku. Ultimately, we do not apprehend anything because our speech is not yet correct. We babble away, right? As human beings, we can't help ourselves. We babble a lot. I think that's a closer rendering of this verse. Okay, so next, Dongshan gets into his the kind of the meat of his attempt to explain all this. And for us, it's the hardest part, actually. So this is partly verse 9 and 10. It is like the six lines of the illumination hexagram, relative and ultimate interact, piled up, they make three. The complete transformation makes five. Now this makes no sense at all, unless you know something about the I Ching, or the Book of Changes, the oldest of the Chinese classics, which dates back possibly as early as the 10th century before Common Era. That's really old. So let me just say that I know next to nothing about the I Ching or how to use it. So my apologies to anyone who knows more than me. I thank Sheng Yan in his commentary for helping me with this. The I Ching was used as a means of divination based on the permutations of six stacked horizontal lines called hexagrams, some broken in half, some not. And the different arrangements of hexagrams would have numbers and names which corresponded to portions of the text, which would give guidance in decision-making or predicting the future. So Dongshan, in this case, is using the hexagrams as a kind of graphic aid to explaining what are called the five ranks. Dongshan's five ranks. Now, ranks is, I don't think, a really good word, but then levels isn't much better because they're, you know, they imply a hierarchy or a linearity. But they are meant to depict how a practitioner moves through the levels of practice towards enlightenment. And Dongshan and his students would have been well acquainted with the I Ching. So it made sense for him to utilize it, you know, as a teaching aid. But we might need a little graphic assistance. So I am going to see if I can screen. Am I able to screen share? Tim, can you? Who's the host? Tim, can you click, do a right click on me and or on participants? You can click on participants and on me, make me co-host. Sorry, I forgot to ask earlier. So that.
Yeah. Still don't. I updated my version and it doesn't allow that co-host business anymore. The only thing I can do now is chat or pin.
What?
Yeah.
Well, that's strange. You sure you can't? You can't make somebody else co-host?
Not it. So I've done this before, where I click on the on your name.
Yeah.
And there's a blue box that says more with a little arrow on it.
Yeah.
And I click on that, and the two options come up that say chat or pin.
Ah.
And that's it. Sorry.
Okay. Oh boy. Oh, I left it upstairs. Oh, I need you to be able to see this. Hang on. It would really help if you can see this. I'm going to pause my recorder. Okay. Thank you for your patience. So, can you see this page? Okay, see those lines? See if I can. That is called a trigram. So you'll see six lines, two of them are broken, and four of them are not. See, the top one's not, next one down is broken. And you can see how they can make three pairs in a vertical sequence. And you can also see how they've been combined into five sets of two. See, they're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sets of two. Okay, so that's what the poem is saying. It's like six lines of the illumination hexagram. Sorry. Relative and ultimate interact. Piled up, they make three. The complete transformation makes five. So when he says relative and absolute, first, to say the unbroken line, I'm going to put this down for a minute. The unbroken line stands for the yang principle of yin and yang. So action, light. And the broken line stands for the yin principle, non-action, darkness. So Dongshan is using the broken and unbroken lines to represent relative and absolute. delusion and awakening, samsara and nirvana. Okay. The broken and the unbroken lines are also referred to as center and off-center respect, which seems kind of counterintuitive. But the whole point is, as Shanyan explains, that in Zen, delusion and awakening, samsara and nirvana, relative and absolute, are not separate, but interact in different ways depending on our practice. So we have the first level. Okay, see these little circles? First level is that one. Dark and smaller light. So first level is, it's called the off-center within the center, meaning you're basically immersed in delusion, but you've had glimpses of awakening, right, of the absolute. So that's the white. And you're focusing your practice towards that. Okay, second level is called the center within the off-center. That's this one, the white and the black. Okay? And that one is, you have more experience of wisdom or awakening, and thus you're even more keenly aware of your delusion. So you're kind of focusing on that and really practicing actively with your delusion. The third level is called coming in the center. That's that one with the dot in the middle. And here, delusions still come up, but they're completely in the embrace of wisdom. So they don't burst out and do harm. Okay? And that level is called the pivot of the five levels. See, it's kind of in the middle in this graphic. The fourth is called arrival with dual aspects. And although it appears completely white, that's that one, completely purified of delusion. But Shangyan says, without delusion, the wisdom of awakening cannot arise. It's static, right? So there's this fifth level, which is called perfection on both counts, and that's the black circle. In which delusion is wisdom. They're merged. They co-arise. And this is the wisdom and the compassion of the bodhisattva who can live right here in the world of samsara, manifesting what our friend Dogen calls practice, the unity, the oneness of practice, realization, and actualization. And that really can't happen in the white circle. It can happen here in everyday life with ordinary people like us. So that all sounds very complicated and abstract. So please don't worry too much about understanding these so-called five ranks. I've heard that Dogen wasn't fond of them, but I have not yet been able to find where Dogen says that. So that's hearsay, don't quote me, because I don't even remember who said it. And so I'm curious to see if I can track that down, that Dogen wasn't fond of the five ranks. But it's a construct, right? It's a model that Dongshan used to help his students understand. For example, you know how when people start practice, maybe you have, and get really excited about the prospect of getting enlightened, right? That's really deluded, but there's that prospect of enlightenment out there to go, oh, I really want that, right? And so seeing that model can help kind of articulate that. But then after some months or even years, then they start to notice that they're actually getting more acutely aware of their pernicious habit patterns and delusions. And they may wonder, what am I doing this for? Am I getting anywhere? Have you ever felt like that? You know, so that's the white with the black, the delusions, you know. Oh, you know, they're, how can they still be so intense? And yet, that's where we're practicing. You know, it's like the cutting edge, where the cutting edge is, we could say. And then there's that pivot point, right, where the practice is stabilized. You know, delusion arises, but it doesn't manifest out in our speech and words. It's not suppressed, it just arises and subsides. And the fourth is that experience of deep, deep samadhi. And the fifth is the samadhi of living in the world. There's the samadhi of deep emptiness, and there's the samadhi of living in the world on the bodhisattva path. Probably you've seen pictures of the Zen ox herding. Have you seen the Zen ox herding pictures? We did a series on them one time. And some of them, I have this beautiful book somebody gave Michael years ago in Japan. And it has like six different versions of the ox herding pictures. Some of them are a series of 10, some a series of six, one series is even four. But some of them have that sequence of the ox starting out completely black, and then a little bit of white, and more white, and then completely white, and then disappearing into an Enso circle. And then, so I'm just going to show you this one series a little bit. Maybe you can see, Sarah, there's the black ox. And oops. And now he's a little bit whiter. And a little bit whiter. And more. And now he's almost all the way white. And then he's all the way white. Each one's different. Some of them disappear. Some of them, like that version, disappears into an Enso. And then some of the versions, but not all, have a final picture of what's called returning to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. So this is the bodhisattva path, returning to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. So you see, again, this is a little more accessible, I think, than the five ranks, actually. But like so many stage models, whether it's enlightenment or human development or grief or the Eightfold Path itself, it's not so linear and tidy as it appears. We can move from one of these places to the other, I think, on our path. And it's good, kind of, you know, it's helpful to be able to recognize them, right? Even people with profound experiences of emptiness who maybe didn't develop into returning to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. People with profound experiences of emptiness can slip back into some pretty deluded and harmful places, particularly if they haven't taken care of some other aspects of human development. So these are their tools, you know. They're skillful means. But in reality, each stage kind of can open into all the others. And they are contained within each other. Each contains the potential of all the others, we could say. And Dongshan tells us this metaphorically in the next line. So we're looking at verse 10. He says, it is like the taste of the five-flavored herb, like a diamond thunderbolt. The five-flavored herb is apparently a kind of hyssop, said to have five subtly different flavors, and yet if you taste one, you taste them all. So there it is, right? Each one containing all the rest. And the diamond thunderbolt is that Vajra scepter of esoteric Buddhism. So there are five prongs coming out of one base. So again, another image of to amplify that. So, verse 11, Dongshan continues, subtly included within the true, inquiry and response come up together. That first line in the Japanese is given as a direct quote from the Chinese. There are four characters. The first one is right or correct, so that's the true, and then middle or center. And the third one is subtle or wondrous, and then between. So this translation says subtly included within the true, and Shengyan, sorry, I'm a translation geek, I can't help it. Shengyan says the exact center subtly harmonizing. So it seems to be referring to that pivot point, that turning center of this dynamic practice. Subtly enclosed within the true, the exact center harmonizing with the rest is what this seems to be saying. And then that second line, I was quite delighted to see. It doesn't say inquiry and response come up together. It says drumming and singing arise together. Which I love, because it's the call and response of self and world. It's the call and response of being in the world with the 10,000 things. And that line, the drumming and singing are coming, arising together, made me think of the final part of Hakuin Zenji's Song of Zazen that I'm just going to read for you. With form that is no form, going and coming, we are never astray. With thought that is no thought, even singing and dancing are the voice of the Dharma. How boundless and free is the sky of samadhi, how bright the full moon of wisdom. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is right here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land, this very body the Buddha. So I think that resonates. Hakuin Zenji's Song of Zazen resonates very nicely with the Song of Jewel Mirror Samadhi. And that's probably a good place to stop for today with the drumming and singing rising up together. So if that leaves us any time for further discussion or questions, what do you think, Tim?
Well, why not? Huh? A few minutes?
Anybody have any reflections or to share, or thoughts or questions? Maggie? Yeah?
Good evening, everyone. You know, in number three in the picture that you showed us on screen, and you mentioned coming in the center. So I know a little bit about my center, but I wonder if you might be able to speak to that a bit more.
Well, what this image is referring to is a kind of centered self-awareness within which we can see really clearly what's arising. So we're not driven by what arises. We can I'm trying to... There's a wonderful saying... and I'm forgetting the Japanese, but in English it's something like being led by vow rather than being pulled by karma, right? So if we're not centered, if we're not aware of our reactivity and all our habit patterns, we're going to be pulled by karma, and we're going to perpetuate maybe some harmful karma. But if we are, if we have that centered awareness, we can be aligned with our vow and led by vow. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
It's a whole month ago, so I don't expect anybody to remember, but somebody had a question last time that I was going to look at the Japanese and answer, but I don't remember what the question was.
Well, I think it was me, Kate, where I was curious about this reference of it all the time. And you were addressing that quite thoroughly this evening. So
I had a feeling that was it. That was it.
Yeah. Yeah. Literally and figuratively. Yes. So thank you. And you did a marvelous job. So that helped a lot. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And thank you in general for tonight.
Any other questions or thoughts? Then to be continued, eh?
Indeed. And before we do our closing chant, I just want to remind folks that Kate and Michael earn their living through offering the Dharma and practice. And if you could find your way to